Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back here to the program Rick Karch from Rick's Automotive Service in Champaign. He is here generally once every season, every 3 months. What we're trying to do is have him on the program to answer questions about cars and car maintenance. And the deal is here, if you're having a problem with your vehicle, whatever kind of vehicle you have, give us a call, tell us what it is, give us the make and model, and give the best description you can of the problem, and Rick will do his best to do some troubleshooting and tell you what to look at. You have other sorts of general questions that have to do with maintenance issues. I'm sure that we can take those too. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good any place that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Thanks very much for being here once again.
You're welcome.
We're now in winter, and we have had some pretty cold this weekend. It sounds like we're going to have quite cold temperatures. What in the wintertime, what's the biggest problem that people have with their cars?
Well, I guess batteries kind of come to mind, but you know, you have to remember that actually there's more battery failures in the summer than there are in the winter. But as a general rule, as far as the battery is concerned, if the battery is 5 years old, you should replace it.
Okay.
And that's just kind of a general rule I've always used, because it seems after that point, of course, when there is a battery failure problem, it's always the wrong time, the wrong place.
Probably worse in the wintertime. Maybe that's why people think about it more in the winter, because when you get up and if the car won't start, that may be a bigger issue.
And the other indication of a battery problem, or maybe a charging system problem, the alternator is what charges the battery. So when you first turn the key on, all the red lights that come on, you'll have one in there that looks like a battery symbol. Mm-hmm. And when you're trying to start the car before it actually starts running, while the starter is engaged, you can kind of tell if you've driven the same car over a period of time when you crank the car, crank the engine, how quickly it turns over. Right. And if it seems to you that it's turning over a little bit slower, it might be a good indication that the battery needs to be tested. Or maybe, as I mentioned earlier, if it's 5 years old or older, it should definitely be replaced.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, we have here a caller to bring into the conversation to start us off. And here on line number one, we'll talk with them. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, I've got a question about my wife's car. She's got an 07 Pontiac with a GTB, I believe, you know, the fancy one with those high-performance tires.
Okay.
Are you familiar with what I'm talking about? You know, the back tires are actually bigger than the front tires. And she's always drove a lot. She no longer drives that much. But she used to get about 65,000 miles out of her tires. And everyone's been saying, we're lucky to get 25 out of that. Well, she's approaching 20. Is there a way of putting regular conventional wheels on that car and getting rid of those tires and wheels?
Well, it's not...
You know what I'm talking about now, don't you?
Yes, so you can get them...
I don't have the size of the tire with me. I'm driving my semi right now, but...
Right.
They are definitely a little wider in the back, and they are the high performance, you know. And they also run flat and the whole bit. You don't even have a spare tire. You just got a little air compressor to do it. So she's not very happy with it. She wished she didn't get that. See, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, basically what you're trying to do is get the tires to the same width and size so you can rotate them.
Right. If I had to buy new rims, anyway, because I don't think they'd fit on that rim.
That particular vehicle, or any vehicle that has wider tires on the rear, it's a design feature.
I know. Yeah.
And you should not deviate from that.
Shouldn't fool with Mother Nature.
Correct.
But, you know, have you had other people complain about that type of stuff?
Well, yes, all the Porsches are that way.
Yeah.
And
a certain one of the Chryslers were that way, too, the high-performance one. But I've got a conventional one. I've got nice high-performance tires, but they're not that type. I don't have any problem. So, but this Pontiac, I don't know. Kind of slipped by us. We wouldn't have bought it if we'd realized that. But, anyway, so that there's no way of just changing them, you don't think, then, huh?
I would not recommend it.
Okay. Well, That's what I needed to know.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Others are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Just back on the subject of batteries, I guess it's like some other things you can pay. There are a range of prices for batteries. And I'm not sure, you know, how big a range there is, but does it really what's the relationship between quality and battery life and price?
Well, most all the batteries that we sell have a 6-year warranty. And when you say it has a 6-year warranty, that means that it's a prorated warranty, kind of like a tire as it wears. Mm-hmm. And the first month, 6 months, if it fails, it's replaced at 100%. And then every year thereafter, it loses value. So after so many years, it's worth half what it was when you originally purchased it. As far as price, yes, there's quite a variety in pricing. There's also quite a variety in quality of batteries. So you need to kind of do a little research. There are certain manufacturers that I feel are worth the extra value in terms of expense because it's definitely a better product. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're only talking, you know, a battery typically is in the $80 to some batteries are $130. And, of course, you can buy them for less than that. But that's kind of the range for most of the good quality batteries.
Okay.
And you might be talking another $30 for a high quality battery that will be dependable.
Oh, so it's not an enormous difference, and you think that it could be that it would be worth spending a little bit more money for more reliable.
I feel it is. You've got the inconvenience of a battery issue. You've got to take it back. You've got to wait. If there's a failure with the battery and the car has to be towed, you know, towing charges are anywhere from $60 to $70 just in town. And then if it's an out-of-town tow, they base it upon mileage.
Yeah. Is there going to be a big difference in battery life between somebody who has a garage and can keep it in there, particularly if it's heated, or at least it's going to be warm on the outside, and someone whose car is going to have to sit outside in all weathers?
I'm really not sure. My first reaction to the answer is no. I think the batteries of technology is at the point now where they can deal with extreme cold and extreme heat. But I don't design batteries, so I don't know specifically.
Okay. So that shouldn't – if you're – it sounds from what I hear is that if you don't have a garage and your car sits outside, that shouldn't really be a problem.
I don't feel that way. As long as everything engine-wise is okay, cables are fine, starter is fine. I mean, if you buy a battery in Alaska, it's not any different than the battery you would buy in Florida.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't manufacture.
They don't make batteries for cold places and batteries for hot places.
No.
Okay. Let's talk with some other folks. Next is another Urbana caller, or an Urbana caller. Line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Your program is so important. Rick, I have a 1989 Mercury Marquis, and it was given to me, so it's very valuable to me from my father. And the power steering pump has gone out, and everywhere I go to get one, they tell me I can get the power steering pump, but there's something that has to be taken off of it, and I'm not sure what they're talking about. Are you familiar with that?
Well, as a general rule with the Mercury or Ford products, maybe what they're referring to is the pulley.
Yes, that's what he said. A pulley has to
be
taken off.
And it takes a special tool to pull it off and press it back on.
Okay, now is it worth, it's an 89 Mercury Mark, it has sentimental value to me.
Right.
But the cost, I don't want to, you know, the sentimental value to overtake the cost, and I'm trying to preserve it. If I can keep my wife out of it, I can keep it another 20 years. But is it worth, you know, getting it repaired and getting the pulleys taken off? And
well, obviously it is from a sentimental standpoint.
Right, I know that.
Now, is this pump noisy or is it leaking?
It just leaks.
Leaks, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I would definitely have it replaced. I mean, it's not that huge of an expense.
So what is the process? You have to take it somewhere else to get the pulleys taken off?
Yes, yes.
Okay, and does your shop do that?
Yes, we do.
Okay, well, you got some business, Rick.
Okay, well, I appreciate that.
Thank you. Right.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. We'll go on here. Next caller is in Champaign, and this is line number two. Hello?
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a... In coming up to a red light in town, I have a tendency to... I think I'm saving brake power, brakes, that I will drop it into a lower gear, which slows it down quite a bit as I'm coming up to that red light, and I just wonder, am I being foolish or crazy or smart or what? Have any thoughts on that?
Well, a lot of people drive that way. It's not really necessary.
It doesn't save on brakes that
not
much.
Not really that much.
I'm always amazed that people race around me to coming up on a red light and then slam on their brakes. It's hard to believe, but... the other thing I have a concern about, I have a Buick Lucerne and my wife has a Ford Focus. And when I drop one gear from automatic from drive to, say, three on the Buick, you can't tell any difference at all. And when I'm, like, having reverse and then pull it down without looking at it, it ends up on three rather than drive. It bypasses that. And the other day, going to Chicago, I realized I was halfway to Rantoul that I was in three. And I thought, oh, my gosh, but you can't really tell the difference. And in the Ford, you drop it one gear, and it just it really slows it down a lot.
Are we talking about the Focus is also automatic?
Yes, right, okay. Both automatic.
Well, when you move the shifter from D to 3, you prevent it from going into overdrive.
Yeah.
And overdrive occurs typically in the 35 to 45 mile an hour range, and it's very subtle. It's maybe, I mean, if you had a tachometer, you would actually see it occur.
Yeah.
But you really have to be paying attention.
Well, unfortunately, with the Buick, it just automatically, it seems without looking at it, you pull it down, and
yes,
usually it stops on drive, but in this case, it just goes right down to three, and you can't tell the difference, which is rather amazing. So,
well, yeah. The next time you drive it, you know, get up to, say, 35 mile an hour with the shifter in D, and then slowly accelerate, and you should feel it shift up into a higher gear, which would be overdrive.
Right. Good.
Yes.
Right. Okay, good enough. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Once again, the number here for Champaign or Urbana folks is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Our guest is Rick Karch from Rick's Automotive Service. It's in Champaign. And if you have some car care questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. When people buy a car, there's a sticker on there that says what the gas mileage the car is going to get. And that's something that's determined by the government, and they do this in the laboratory. They don't take it out on the road and do it. They have a way of doing it that some people would argue is not like real-world driving conditions, or at least everybody drives their car differently. Your driving habits, your driving style, where you drive, how you drive will affect your mileage. So, and that's why I think that some people sometimes have complained. They say, well, the sticker says I'm supposed to get these many miles per gallon. But my experience is that my mileage isn't that good. So all this comes down to this question. Are there some basic things about the way people drive? Those kinds of things about what you do when you approach a stop sign, or what you do when you're starting, or anything else like that that you would say really can determine have some impact on mileage.
Well, obviously, driving habits, like you mentioned, are most important. Acceleration, deceleration. If you're on the highway, you always want to use the cruise control, because every time you're modulating the gas, accelerating or decelerating, you're affecting fuel mileage. Tire pressure is very important with regards to fuel mileage. But yes, driving habits are probably the number one influencing factor. But you're right about the testing. It's very unusual to get what they say.
And as far as maintenance, it sounds like the big thing is make sure that your tires are at the recommended pressure.
Yes.
That's going to make a difference.
Yes. Tire pressure is very important, and tire pressure is checked when the tires are cold. And most vehicles, when you open the driver's door, there'll be a sticker on the door jamb area there where the latch is for the door or below it. They'll indicate the correct tire pressures for the car, and that's what you should use.
Yeah, and when you say cold, that means that you have you haven't been driving the car. So
correct.
If you're going to check them when you get up before you take your first trip in the car of the day, that's the time to check.
Yes, that's correct.
Right. Is the pressure going to vary much between, say, we take the pressure in July and in January? Does the outside temperature makes a difference?
Ambient temperature will affect the actual tire pressure. So weather like this, typically you're going to find tire pressures to be lower than they should be.
Hmm.
And if you're going to, anytime you get an oil service, oil change, there's a lot of different variables there in terms of the services. Some they just change the oil and filter. But each time you have an oil service, it's a good idea to specify that they do check tires and tire pressures for you.
Okay. Let's talk with some other folks here. And Champagne is next, line number one. Hello. Is there line one, Champagne?
Yes, hi.
Hi.
My husband borrowed my car this morning, or started to go to a meeting in Chicago, and he called me and said the windshield wipers were just going really slow. He couldn't get them to speed up at all, so they decided to find another car to take. But short of maybe an alternator going out, can you think of anything at all that would just make the windshield wipers go slow?
Well, you have to compare it to some other things. For example, if you have the headlights on and you pull up to a building, for example, where you can watch the headlights while you're sitting in the vehicle and you let the car idle and then you accelerate the car, typically the headlights will increase in brightness just a little bit, but it's really hard to see, particularly at daylight. As far as the wipers going slow, that could be just something associated with the motor itself.
Operator failure?
No, I wouldn't think operator would have any. I mean, they're either on or they're off. So I don't think there's anything to do with that.
So there is a motor just for the wipers?
That's correct. That's correct. I mean, if you had an alternator problem, the vehicle would just be running on the battery only, and you would be able to tell that by the way it starts or inability to start. If the battery gets discharged enough.
But that could happen fairly suddenly. Like, I didn't notice it yesterday, but it could happen today. Or is that normally something you see coming for a few days?
If there's a problem with the alternator or the battery light should be illuminated on the dash.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, thank you. And I'm assuming that you would also say that if any of those warning indicator lights come on your dash, don't ignore that. Pay attention to that. Look in your manual, see what it says, and if you have any doubts, you should take it to somebody and have them take a look at it.
Right. And when you first turn the key on, some of the lights are red, some of the lights are yellow.
Mm.
Okay. The red lights mean stop, and the yellow lights are caution. So any red light that is illuminated, you should pull over to the side of the road and shut the vehicle off. Some safe area. And if you're not sure what the light represents, like you mentioned, you can look in the owner's manual. Usually they'll have a little symbol on there that you can associate with something.
Mm-hmm.
Like I mentioned earlier, the alternator looks like a little battery. The oil light will look like a little oil can. You've got a temperature gauge that'll look like a little thermometer. And, of course, typically with brake pads, those lights are yellow. As far as the sensors are concerned, it varies from manufacturer to manufacturer as far as how many different things are being monitored by those lights.
Okay. Our guest here this morning is Rick Karch from Rick's Automotive in Champaign, and he's generally here with us every season, and we talk about cars and car care. If you have a question, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think next we'll talk with someone in Muhammad, line 2. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. I got a 96 Ford Explorer, and I went to go start my vehicle the other day, and I turned the ignition on, and the starter kept running, but the car didn't actually start. The starter was just running. I tried turning the switch back, you know, off, and pulled the key out, and the starter just kept running. So after about 3 minutes of the starter running, it finally stopped. Do you think this is a solenoid problem or maybe a starter ignition switch problem?
It's more than likely the solenoid is stuck closed. So it's going to require the starter motor and the solenoid.
Okay. Yeah, because I'm just hoping that I didn't mess up the starter or anything. I didn't hear any grinding. The starter is about 6 months old, and I had a flywheel changed out on that, too. So I'm just hoping I didn't damage the starter or anything. Do you think that would have happened? Or, I mean, what would have caused the starter to eventually stop? Would that be the solenoid coming unjammed?
Yes, once the contact's released. Now, so you might go through your paperwork. You said you had a flywheel replaced and a starter.
Yeah.
But you might look at your paperwork and see if they replaced the solenoid also.
I don't believe so.
Okay. Well, that should be replaced at the same time as the starter.
Oh,
so
okay.
If it's only been 6 months, it should still have a full warranty in terms of parts and labor.
Okay, okay. Well, I think that actually the business that did the work closed down. So.
Oh well, you might, depending on how your paperwork is broken down, if you can identify the manufacturer of the part, or think you know maybe where they purchased it from, you might be able to contact a shop, and they might be able to work with that part store to try to archive that information.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot. I appreciate
welcome.
It.
All right, thank you. Let's go to Urbana, line 1, for somebody else. Hello.
Hello, yes. I have a 95 Subaru Legacy, and I live here in Urbana, so I never use my handbrake, parking brake, but when I go out in the morning after not using it, I turn on the car, and the light on the console says brake like it's on. And I've tried, like, really jamming it on and then releasing it, and that light will stay there until later in the day, I think until it gets warmer, and then the light will go off. I don't notice any restriction when I'm driving.
Yes. Most of the vehicles that have the red brake light represent two things. One, as you mentioned, the emergency brake being on. Number two, it represents the brake fluid level in the reservoir. So if you open the hood and visually look at the brake fluid reservoir container, it's kind of a translucent white container on the driver's side just in front of you. There'll be a min mark and a max mark. And visually you can see where that is, and if you can't quite see it, just grab the top of it and kind of wiggle it, and you should see the fluid move. And there's a possibility that it's right at the minimum mark, and as we know, when fluids are heated, they expand. So therefore, that level would rise, and maybe that's why the light goes out later on, or after it's been in the sun, or after it's been driven, and you get underhood temperatures associated with that.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Sure.
All right, thank you. And again, we'll go to another caller, and the next person in line would be in Matt Toon, line 4. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I have an 85 S10 pickup that when I noticed when I put it in reverse, would kind of like want to grind. You couldn't get it in gear. You took and shut the motor off, you could put it in gear. And then driving it a little bit, I found that it seemed like when you put the clutch all the way down and go to start it in a forward position, then the vehicle kind of would want to start to go when you were turning the motor on.
It's associated with the hydraulics of the clutch. What you might try doing the next time, basically what's happening is when you're depressing the clutch, it's supposed to release the clutch disc. In other words, it should be freewheeling at that time. So if you have a hydraulic problem, which usually refers to as an internal leak, is that when you depress the clutch pedal, it's leaking internally, so it's releasing the release bearing toward the pressure plate, which then clamps the disc. What you might try doing is pumping the clutch pedal two or three times and see if that makes a difference. And if that makes a difference, then you need to have the clutch slave and the clutch master cylinder replaced.
Okay, now I had just, say, a couple hundred miles ago or so, had the hydraulic fluid changed.
Okay, well, maybe there's air in the system, or those two components need to be replaced.
Okay, we'll give that a try.
Okay.
All right, thanks for the call. Again, and our guest this morning is Rick Hartz from Rick's Automotive Service in Champaign, and we're here talking about car care. If you have maintenance questions, you have a problem, call in, tell us about the car, tell us about the problem, and Rick will see if he can help you out. We have somebody who was listening to you talking about cruise control and the fact that you recommend that if you're going to be driving out on the highway that you use cruise control. And certainly around here, we got a lot of spaces that are just really flat, but the caller says even though going, say, up to Chicago on 57, there actually are some places where it's a little bit hilly, and sometimes he says he feels like, you know, the car's got to work a little harder to get up the hill. Would you say if you're going to some ups and downs, would you pop off the cruise control to get up the hill, or would you just leave it on the whole time?
What I do, I use cruise control a lot. And when I see a hill coming up, I'll actually help the cruise control. I'll slightly accelerate so that the cruise control doesn't have to work quite as hard. Mm-hmm. Because if you wait till the last minute, the cruise control, I mean, it can't see like you. So it just senses that the RPM is going down, the miles per hour is going down. And if it goes down quickly, then it's going to rapidly accelerate the vehicle. So you can help the system. Just kind of squeeze it a little bit, accelerate 2 or 3 mile an hour above where you are. Mm-hmm. And then as the vehicle gets nearer and nearer and starts to go up the hill, the cruise control won't. Sometimes it'll even decelerate or drop down a gear, and then, of course, the RPMs go up real high. The other thing with cruise control, if you're using cruise control and you're towing a trailer or anything, you should not leave it in overdrive. It should be out of overdrive, because kicking in and kicking out of overdrive, every time it kicks in and kicks out, it generates heat. Internal transmission temperature escalates. And if you read your zoner manual, it'll tell you the same thing, that anytime you're towing, you tow without overdrive. Mm-hmm. So,
okay. Back to the phones here. And Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. I have a question about using synthetic oil. I've been using synthetic oil to try to reduce the amount of oil that I'm using in my car and extend the life of the car. And, you know, the regular oil, it says you're supposed to change it about 5,000 miles in my car in the manual. I'm not sure when I should change the synthetic oil, whether I should change the filter only, or if I should change the whole thing, oil and filter, at the same time. Could you speak about that?
Sure. When you say losing oil, you mean the engine is consuming oil?
No, using oil.
It's using oil.
No, I mean just in terms of how much oil I use in my car. You know, every time I change the oil, I'm using 4 quarts.
Oh, okay. So you're not adding oil.
No.
Okay. All right. Sorry. Okay. As far as number one, you should change the oil and the filter together.
Okay.
As far as the mileage is concerned, you can go 7,500 miles.
Okay. And that's universal for all synthetics?
That's what I use as a number.
Okay.
Some manufacturers will allow higher numbers.
Okay.
But
does it matter about the driving conditions if it's cold weather or if you do a long trip where you drive like 18 hours in a row?
As far as the 7,500 miles?
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
No, I would just stay with the 7,500-mile interval. And using the synthetic oil, I mean, you're smart. Obviously, it's a little more expensive, but it definitely is superior in terms of maintaining the engine and the bearings and longevity in particular. And the other thing that's nice about the synthetic is, particularly if the vehicle sits outside, the synthetic oils don't gel or get thicker like conventional oil does in cold weather.
Okay, thank you.
Sure, thank you. Again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, you got questions, you can pick up the telephone and give us a call. One thing I just was sort of curious about, now it seems that we're starting to see some cars, and I'm not sure how many, but I know I've seen some cars that have a keyless ignition. And the way it works is that you have a little handheld device, which is the thing you use to open the doors. And then it has a sensor in it that it knows it's in the car. So if you have it in your pocket or if you have it sitting on the dash, then the car knows, okay, I can start now. And then there's just a button that you push that starts the car. And I think that maybe we're moving in the direction so that more and more new cars are going to have that feature. Is that something I guess first of all, my question would be, well, what's the why?
Why?
What exactly is the point? The key seems to work okay.
I think that's a good question. I remember the first time I saw that, it was kind of like, these engineers have too much free time. I mean, you take something basic and simple and you complicate it. You know, so now we got an issue where, okay, if this battery goes down in the transmitter or the battery goes down in the car, I mean, there are cars that if the remote is still functional and the car battery is dead, you still can't get in the car. You have to some of these cars, I've had to jack them up, get underneath the car to get to the starter motor to power up the car so that you could actually open the doors. So... yeah, I don't know why they're doing this stuff. It seems to me it's making things more complicated than they need to be.
Well, do you see a lot of mechanical problems that have to do with the mechanism, that place where you put the key in and you turn it? Is that subject to various kinds of failure, so you have problems with that, with the car not starting just because there's something wrong with that?
The only time you really have problems with ignitions, mechanical portions of ignition switches, is when people hang a lot of keys on there. And the tumblers inside there are brass, so they're very soft. And it's like a lever, and it wears in there. And then sometimes you get to the point where you have to lift the key up a little bit before you can rotate it clockwise. So you really don't want a lot of keys dangling. If you have a lot of keys, you should have two keychains, you know, one for your office or your warehouse or whatever requires all these extra keys, and then of course maybe two or three can hang from the actual ignition switch. But getting back to your question about the keyless starting, I feel a lot of it just simply goes back to security and anti-theft. You know, a lot of these vehicle manufacturers, you know, they always publish lists about theft rates and things like that, and I think this is what the intent is.
Oh, so the idea is that somehow that would make it more difficult to steal a vehicle.
More difficult. Anything that slows down the ability of a thief to get the car started obviously is an advantage.
Yeah, okay. Well, I guess, though, then going back to the maintenance issue we were talking about, if you have one of these kind of cars, well, it sounds like it's even more important to make sure that you got a good battery in there, because
right.
You don't want to get it to the point
right.
where you can't start, you can't even get in it.
Yeah, the remotes, a good indication of a remote battery going down, a lot of them will have a little light that will actually flash to indicate that. But like when you first bought the vehicle and you could open the doors 50 feet away, and then it became 40 feet, and then it became, well, I have to be standing next to the door like I'm actually unlocking it myself. Well, that's a good indication that battery's getting low and it should be replaced. And most of the drugstores sell those batteries. They're typically circular in nature, like a watch battery.
Uh-huh. Okay. Let's talk with some more folks. Next, we'll talk with someone in Mattoon, line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have two questions. I have a 2001 Ford Taurus wagon with only 25,000 miles on it, and as you can tell, I don't drive a whole lot with it. With the oil, do I wait 3 months to change the oil, or because I don't get the 7,000 miles or the 3,000? And the other question is, when driving on a trip, I usually have a real heavy load for this station wagon. And the tires are the original tires with good tread, and I usually check the pressure, and it goes, you have it up around 35 or so when I start out. And it really bumps when I hit the joints in the road on the interstates. And sometimes just out on any highway where they have the joints in the highway, and it just really bumps, and you can really tell it now. Is that something on the shock absorbers, or is that too much pressure in the tires, or is that connected with the load, or because I do have a pretty heavy load?
Well, my first reaction would be that it has to do with the tire itself.
I have what?
My first reaction is it has to do with the tires themselves. You know, they're, what, seven-year-old tires? You might carefully look at the sidewall of the tires and between the tread of the tires for any cracks or anything like that.
Well, when I had the car serviced last time, they checked on the sides and there weren't any cracks, and they said the tires were in good shape. And I had them moved around,
mm-hmm.
Even though I didn't really have that many miles on it since they'd been moved around. But the tread seems to be good. Do you think it could be something in the car, on the springs or shock absorbers? Or?
Well, I wouldn't think so. As far as shock absorbers are concerned, they basically minimize the bouncing of the tire. In other words, if you're at highway speeds and you hit a dip in the road, after the dip in the road, the car would keep bouncing.
Air pressure wouldn't have much to do with it?
Well, air pressure will if you overinflate the tires, if you severely low.
Well, I wondered if the pressure build up.
Well, if you start out at the specified pressure, which should be in the driver's door jam area.
Well, it's around 35, I think.
Okay, well then, that's perfect. So, if you're feeling more so of the cracks in the road, again, I go back to the tires. The sidewall, the ability of the sidewall of the tire to absorb that. Obviously, the rubber of the tire is stiffer than it was when it was new. I mean, that's...
It seems to be the same, but I've kind of been concerned about the tires, you know, that long a time.
Right. Yeah, I would think that the tires are creating what you're feeling.
So the mileage really wouldn't have that much to do with it then. More the age.
Yes.
What about the oil?
As far as the oil is concerned, since you're not driving the car much, I would go by the mileage.
Okay. Well, I look at the oil, and they always say the oil looks good when
yes.
I do get it changed.
Yes.
And I used to go by every 3 months, but lately, I've heard that you can wait and wait on it.
Right.
And it doesn't use any oil.
Yeah, as long as the trips that you take, even though they're infrequent, are extended trips, meaning that they're not 5 miles or less. Basically, what breaks down the oil is water. In other words, short trips, you get condensation builds up in the crankcase, and it never really gets warm enough to evaporate that fluid. But if you're taking trips of length, and the vehicle gets up to operating temperature for 20 minutes or more, then you're perfectly safe to go by the mileage interval as opposed to
the
time.
Well, I look at the heater, on the gauge, and I usually have the thing up to where it usually goes for not hot, but, you know, in the middle.
Right.
And each time. And usually when I'm driving it, I do drive it up at least it gets maybe 4, 5, 6 miles on it, and sometimes if I have to a quick stop, I might leave the motor running a little bit just to help the battery or to get it so it's warm.
Yes. I think you're fine with the mileage.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you. Over to a caller in Normal next, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have a Honda Accord 2000, however, I got it in the fall of 99, and it has about 56,400 on it. I don't drive it very much. Well, I drive it a lot of short trips that you were talking about. Anyway, having trouble with the reverse gear. I have trouble getting into the reverse gear.
What about first?
The other gears seem to be okay.
When you say trouble, do you mean it's like it's fighting you or it's grinding?
Well, I just have trouble, especially when it's cold in the morning, just getting it into reverse.
But when it's warm, it's okay?
It's variable. Sometimes it's not. I haven't had a case where I couldn't get it in at all, but I have had occasions where, after it's parked and it gets a little cold, then it's hard to get it in.
Okay, well, getting back to my question, when you're trying to get it into reverse, is it hard to move the shifter?
Yeah, it's a manual car. I guess
yeah, I understand.
I should have pointed that out. It's manual.
I understand.
Okay.
And then as far as moving the shifter from, say, first to second?
Yeah, I've tried all of that. Well, it's all the other gears I have not had a problem with. And okay. I've tried, going from second to reverse, everything.
Okay.
And it's not always like this, but it's increasing.
Well, you might have someone take a look at it. Just to verify that the linkage isn't binding, they can check the hydraulics, and they can also check the quality of the oil in the transmission. Are you doing the normal servicing?
Yeah, I don't do it quite as often as they say because, I've had this thing almost, 8.5 years, and
right.
I've only got 56,000, but I do it, every 3 months at least, and maybe more often.
Well, I'm talking about the normal servicing, like if there's a service at 30,000,
oh, 45. Yes, I've done that. In fact, I've done it early because, I'm not even up to the mileage that where you're supposed to have the maintenance.
Right.
So I've done all the maintenance at the Honda dealer.
Okay. All right. Well, you might have them specifically ask them to look at those two areas for you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I did, and I so far have not gotten an answer, so I thought I would ask you now. Last time I was there last week or so, they said they popped off the transmission fluid, I think. That was down a little bit, but that has not changed what happens with the reverse. It's about the same.
I see. Well, there may be, if it's not an external problem, meaning the linkage, and the clutch is fully disengaging, which it sounds to me like it is, and the fact that you're not having trouble with first gear, it may be an internal issue then. Within the transmission.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be very unusual.
Okay. Well, when I was there last time, the guy at the desk, who's not a mechanic, mentioned something about a brake line. Could that be, or is that just crazy?
A brake line?
I don't know if that's the term he used, something to do with the brake. Could that relate to this at all, or is he just completely...
Well, I'm not sure what he was referring to.
Yeah.
But the brakes are separate from the clutch.
Well, that's what I would have thought.
Okay. So maybe he was talking about something else or intertwining an answer with something else. I'm not sure. But the way you've described it is excellent. I mean, it helps in terms of diagnosing it, but it needs to be looked at.
Mm-hmm. So... In other words, you don't really have an idea of what it might be then.
Well, other than what I mentioned, you have external, you have a hydraulics of the clutch, you have the external linkage, and then you have the quality of the fluid, and then if those things are all ruled out, then it's an internal problem within the transmission.
And does that mean they have to replace the whole thing, or can they just do one gear, or what?
Yeah, it can be disassembled and repaired.
Okay, well, that's encouraging. Okay, well,
right.
Thank you.
Thank you. About 5 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Rick Karch from Rick's Automotive Service in Champaign, taking questions on car care. We will take as many as we can in the time that remains, and we'll talk next with a caller in someone here in Champaign County where we are, line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I recently had an alignment done on a 1996 Toyota Camry with about 160,000 miles on it. And certain values that were not within specifications could not be aligned because there's no way to adjust them. and I'm wondering if they could be indicative of another problem that I can do something about. The things that couldn't be adjusted are the front cross SAI, steering axis inclination, and the front and left SAI and included angle.
What about camber?
The camber is okay. That's within specifications.
Okay. Did they check the ride height? In other words, the physical distance the vehicle is from the ground?
Would that have been something that would not normally be done in an alignment?
Well, it should be done. You might call them back and inquire about the ride height.
Okay. All I have is the printout of the specified ranges and you know, the actual and before and what they could and could not. And what's on here that they checked were for the front and right camber, caster, toe, SAI, included angle, and turning angle differential. And then for the front, they've got cross camber, cross caster, cross SAI, total toe, and cross turning differential. And then for the rear, camber and toe, cross camber, total toe, and thrust angle.
And the thrust angle is what? Is it near zero?
It is. Now, that one, it is the before it was minus 0.03 degrees, and it ended up being minus 0.02 degrees. But that's the only one that has a reading that doesn't have a specified range.
That's correct, but as close to zero as possible. Basically, what thrust angle is, to make it real simple, is thrust angle when it's zero means that the front axle, we don't really have a front axle and a rear axle, but if you drew a line through the center of the wheels, as long as that front axle and rear axle are parallel to one another, that's fundamentally that's the thrust angle. In other words, you may have seen cars go down the road sideways.
Mm-hmm.
That means the thrust angle is significantly off. As far as the steering axis inclination is concerned, it's not really going to affect things. As long as camber is okay and toe is okay and caster is okay, you should be fine.
Okay, because it says in their printout that tire wear, handling, and safety problems may result, you know, as a consequence of them not being able to adjust these. Is that just something that...
Well, steering axis inclination is not an adjustable angle.
Is the fact that it's off, is that... mean that there could be something else wrong with the car?
Well, that's why I was asking the question about the ride height.
Uh-huh. Anything besides the ride height?
No, because if it was only a characteristic on one side, something could be bent. But
and since it's on both sides, although it's not the same, it's off a little bit more on the right side than the left side, but it is off on both sides.
Yes. Well, I would ask him that question about the ride height. In other words, the ride height is affected by the springs.
Okay.
And maybe it's just settled, and that's why they had trouble with those angles.
All right.
But like I said, you can't go in there and change them. It's a design relationship.
Okay, but if you press on the car, you know, it doesn't bounce around as though there'd be something really wrong with the springs, but could there be something that is not, you know, real obvious that could still be wrong that then, you know, needs to be replaced?
No, they would have found that. This basically, the springs over time fatigue, kind of like the springs on an old couch.
Uh-huh.
You know, you sit in the couch and you kind of feel like you're in a hammock.
Uh-huh.
And in the course of a new couch, it doesn't do that. So that would be one of the things I would inquire about.
Okay. Now, is that something that can be fixed if the ride height is, you know, maybe it's gotten too low?
Yes, you would replace the springs.
Okay. And other than that's what you think is probably wrong with it, and you don't think it's going to cause safety problems?
No, it will not.
Okay. Or handling problems. Just maybe the ride won't be as good.
But I would at least give them a call.
Okay, all right, thanks much.
All right, sure. Thank you. I'll try real quick to go with somebody else here, and that would be Matt Toon, line 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'll try to make this extremely quick.
Great.
We have a 2007 Camry that we had a remote start added on after purchase. And the thing that seems odd to me is that when you go to the car, it locks when you start it remotely. And then when you go to the car, you unlock it, and the engine shuts off. And I'm wondering if that is standard, if that's typical or not.
Well, when you got this remote start, you should have got a little book with it. Hmm. And a lot of the remote starts are quite sophisticated, and they have several different ways you can program them. So first I would either read the manual or call the installer and ask them specifically those questions.
All right, because on the one hand, it seems like a horrible inconvenience, but on the other, I could see where it would be an anti-theft measure.
Yes.
So, but give them a call.
Yeah, I would. I mean, some of them you can program the factory units. You can program that as soon as you put the vehicle in drive, for example, the locks lock. Some program, when you go 12 mile an hour, they lock.
Right.
But with the aftermarket, that's not always the case. So you just have to read the owner's manual and see what options are in there as far as programming.
Okay. Is that something unusual as far as you've heard that you would, when you unlock the car, it shuts off?
Well, the whole point of having a remote start is so that you can remote start the car, unlock the doors, get in the car, and if you don't put the ignition switch or the key in the ignition switch and turn it to the on position and step on the brake, most of them will shut the car off. But
it's
no.
It's a keyless. It's got the smart key.
Right.
So there's no key for the ignition.
Right. Okay, so it has to do with possibly the way the system is wired to the car that it doesn't recognize that key.
Okay. Alrighty, well then we'll pursue it with the installer.
Okay. All right, well, thanks for the call there. We're going to have to leave it for this time around with the promise. I'm sure that Rick will be back later in the year. Rick Kirch from Rick's Automotive Service in Champaign. He's here with us generally every season to talk about cars. We appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome.